KBOO Portland.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show that focuses on different ways that we might heal our world. Today, I have with me in the studio a very brave woman, Gayathri Ramprasad. And she grew up in India, and as a teenager, she started to succumb to this incredibly debilitating depression. And it sort of would be episodic. She eventually moved to America, actually through an arranged marriage. In India, she was just told to get over it, and she became a mother eventually, and her depression became so serious that she was suicidal more than once, and several times she was locked up in a mental hospital. She wrote a memoir that I found, like, I couldn't put it down. I just read it straight through the whole day, had to finish it. It was very moving. It's called Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. And in it, Gayathri shares her story of understanding and transformation. She tells how she came to overcome the shame and stigma of mental illness, which apparently plagues 450 million people around the world. In 2006, she founded an organization called ASHA International, and that organization is all about bringing an end to the fear and the shame and actually bringing compassion, hope, and wellness to people who are suffering from mood disorders all over the world, including here. And so, Gayathri, I want to welcome you. And by the way, you can't see her, but she is totally beautiful. India, a sari, just incredible. So thanks for showing up.
Namaste, Stephanie. It's my absolute pleasure to be here, and welcome to all of our listeners as well.
Thank you. So Gayathri lives here in Portland, and she's been here, I guess, 20 or 30 years now?
30.
30 years, yeah. So you're basically an American at this point.
I am.
Yeah. Still, I love India. But Gayathri, I read an article in the New York Times just recently, and some schoolgirls had wanted to share their story of mental illness and the story of a bunch of their schoolmates who were into it. The parents had given their permission, but the authorities at the school didn't want to do it because of the stigma and the shame and the problems that the girls might incur later on. And one of the comments I noticed in it was that being mentally ill is now maybe perhaps like it was to be gay, you know, and gays are finally coming out of the closet and being really accepted. But it's still a problem to say that you're mentally ill, and people try to hide that. And would you say that that is a big issue here?
It's a huge issue here in Portland, across the U.S. and around the world. The issue of a lack of understanding of what mental illnesses really are, a lack of understanding that people with mental health issues are people with incredible potential, that they have certain health issues, challenges that when treated and provided the love and community supports, that everyone with a mental health issue can thrive as well. And it's very much similar to the stigma and the shame and the isolation that, people within the LGBT community used to experience in the decades past and centuries past. People started putting a face to it,
right,
and humanizing what it meant to be a lesbian or a gay or a transgender person, underlined, right?
Yes.
And the more we can humanize mental health issues and put a face to these inhumane disorders of the mind, body, and soul, the better off we're all going to be. But the challenge is that disclosure comes with a great deal of risks, as these young girls discovered in
right,
wanting to share their stories. Part of the challenge is the persistent stigma even today here in the U.S. and around the world. Part of it is the shame that accompanies it. But part of it is really the concern from their administrators at school of their own safety.
You know,
it's one thing for me to stand up and disclose my truth, but how would it impact my family?
Right.
My children, my husband's career, right? I mean, these are real questions. And they're hard questions to answer because we still live in a world that's, to the great extent, not as understanding about mental illness as one would hope to be. Science has made huge leaps, taken huge leaps in demystifying mental illnesses so far. But as a society, we are still in our infancy.
We haven't caught up.
We have not caught up.
Right.
We have a long way to go to catch up to understanding that mental illnesses are part of the human experience. It's part of the continuum from illness to wellness.
Right.
And like any other illness that affects humanity at large, this too, when provided the treatment and the love and support, and of course, the incredible hard work of the individual.
And love and support is like, I really got that a lot from reading your book. And I was really touched. I mean, this book really gives me a picture of life in India, at least back in the 50s or the 60s.
60s,
yeah,
yes.
The 60s when you were a child. And I was wondering if you could just share with the listeners a little bit about what that was like for you as a little girl.
Yeah, growing up in India was really fantastical in so many ways. You know, I was born and raised in Bangalore, India, a city in the southern part of India, which is now synonymous with outsourcing. It's the IT capital of India and unfortunately the suicide capital of India as well. But growing up as a little girl in India, it was just magical. I was born and raised in a large extended family of 23 people, grandparents, uncles, aunts, and cousins. So every day was a party, you know.
Yeah.
It was a time of great togetherness, connection,
yeah,
and food and family and fun. So it was a great way, in many ways, a very idealistic childhood. But that gave away as I grew into an adolescent and I began to experience symptoms of what I now know as anxiety and panic and depression. But back then I had absolutely no understanding, neither did my family, nor did my physicians.
And part of that was your family, when your grandfather died, you moved with,
yeah,
your parents into a smaller apartment away from this extended family.
Right. And that was typical in that time in history in India. You know, families that had always lived as joint families, multi-generations living together,
uh-huh,
started to individuate and, uh-huh, split apart. And in some ways, it was great that from my mother's perspective, I think back and go, wow, you know, I could see her blossoming as an,
uh-huh,
individual herself, to have her own space, her own home, her own life at last. Part of it, I'm sure that we lost out on the support in the extended family.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you said you started to exhibit signs of mental illness, how old were you when it?
I was about 18. Uh-huh. When I have distinct memories of really starting to suffer. Part of it, I think, looking back, was the onset of puberty, which I now understand. You know, 50% of the onset of mental illnesses is by the age of 14 and 75% by 24. So I was very typical in that. Uh-huh. You know, the onset was right around.
So it's almost like hormonal changes.
It was, I believe so. It was,
yeah,
very hormonal. But, you know, it's as we know, with any illness or with wellness, you know, it's complex. There are multitudinal factors, right? So it's definitely there was a hormonal trigger to it. And when I was about 18 years old, I was in my undergraduate, you know, studies in college. And one of the things that I was very proud of throughout my life was my academic abilities. You know,
uh-huh,
I aced through school, which was a great pride for my parents. And my father had dreamed of becoming a physician, and he didn't. His dreams were dashed. And so I had believed, and I had dreamed, and I had prayed that I would make his dreams come true, that I would be the first physician in our extended family and the first female physician to boot, right? So I was very, very excited going into college on the way to med school. But in my second year of undergraduate studies, I went to check my results and I was absolutely shocked and traumatized to find out that I had failed in math. And I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand how somebody that had aced through school all her life,
right,
could have failed. I couldn't understand. It's not just the failed grade that had shattered my life. I knew that because one failed grade, and I knew our dreams, mine, my father's, had been derailed forever.
Oh,
that's,
wow,
just the way the system works in India, right? But it was much more than that. It was that I had lost faith in humanity, not just myself, because I couldn't understand how such a thing could have happened. And, you know, as life went on, I learned that a student body leader in my college who wanted me to be his girlfriend, I had no interest in that, and he was incredibly angered by my rejection, and he had sworn that he would make me beg him for mercy. And so this was his, in a retribution, yeah. So to say. This was his way of getting back at me.
And so he bribed some officials?
He bribed the registrars and had made me fail and was gloating about it in college as well. And to make things worse, he was also gloating that he was going to rape me. And this really brings us full circle, because not much has changed in that measure, has it? Because it was only 2 weeks ago that there was a gang rape in my hometown, Bangalore. Wow. And there have been gang rapes, all across India,
right.
As we
so,
know.
Like, your anxiety was, in a certain sense, even justified then.
I mean, of course it was. You know, every day walking to college was a nightmare. Uh-huh. It's like, I write, you know, it's as if the people on the streets, you know, they're catcalls, and, you know, it's as if they measured my morals by the length of my miniskirt and my bob cut hair. They didn't care who I was on the inside. It didn't matter if these men were as old as my father or my uncles or even grandfather. I was fair play.
Yeah.
I was fair play to them. So socially speaking, when we talk about triggers, psychosocially speaking, it was a very threatening place to be. My own hometown, my own neighborhood, going up and down to college was a nightmare, right? So that was a huge trigger. That was a distinct trigger that set off panic attacks, which I didn't know what they were, of course. What I knew was that I would, you know, I would just get completely breathless. I couldn't breathe, and my thoughts would begin to race, and my heart would start pounding, and I would get nauseous and disoriented.
And you were even throwing up to the point where you couldn't hold down food?
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I mean, there were weeks and months at a time where I could not even hold water down. And that became a vicious cycle in of itself. Again, this is where ignorance imprisons all of us. My parents had no idea of what it was. My doctors had no idea what it was, other than telling my parents that I was just being a drama queen, that I needed to get my act together and grow up and mature. Absolutely, get over it. One failed grade, big deal. You know,
yeah.
You're going to take the supplemental exams and pass, and you're going to get over it. So there was no understanding of the emotional aspects of a human being's life at all. So my dad would sit at the table, loving, very loving father. But still, he would sit at one end of the table, glaring down at me and keep saying, you know, you're going to do it again, aren't you? You're going to do it again. You're going to puke again, aren't you? Of course I would.
Oh, God.
Of course I would. And then it became a vicious cycle in of itself.
Because you became terrified that you were going to throw up again.
I was terrified of throwing up. I was terrified of disappointing my father and my mother. I was terrified of dishonoring food, which we consider as a God-given gift in my culture. I was terrified of letting everybody down. And I was already so ashamed of breaking his dreams and mine.
Right. And you found yourself just kind of hiding out, like staying at home, not even getting out of bed.
I couldn't, you know, I couldn't get up and get out of bed. But when college began, and, you know, I was expected to go back, and in a strange way, I knew that my only solace was in going back to school and graduating with a 4.0.
Right. So in a certain way, then, I mean, this was kind of episodic. Like, you could sort of pull yourself out of it again, and then you would find yourself falling back into it again.
Absolutely, which was very confusing
right.
to me and to my parents as well. So in those moments or days or weeks that these symptoms would recede, the question then would become, when they came back again, the question would be, what the heck is wrong with you again? We thought you got a grip over it. We thought you got over it. Why are you acting out again?
And you had no idea.
I had
why.
No answers.
Right.
I didn't know. I knew that I wasn't acting out, that there was something going on. And I was pretty convinced, even at 18, that I was insane, that I was going crazy, and that nobody knew why, and nobody could stop it. Nobody could protect me, including myself or my, you know, family or doctors. And so it's a lack of utter control over your life and your emotions. And it's a very frightening, isolating place to be.
Yeah, definitely. I want to let listeners know, by the way, you can call in and ask Gayathri questions. The number here at KABU is 503 231-8187. She's written a book, Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. Incredible book. The book is also, she also went on to found an organization called ASHA International, which is now helping people around the world. So basically, what we have here is, a caller really wants you to read this to Gayathri. Okay. Gayathri, you are radiant and glowing even though you suffer from depression. Keep shining and glowing. Tyrone Waters.
Oh, Tyrone, thank you. It's Evel Gordley's son, Senator Gordley's son. He's a dear, dear friend. Thank you, Tyrone. Yeah.
Gayathri is now working with politicians and big organizations all over the world. It's amazing where you've come from since you were 18
years old. It's a dream. It's a dream. I pinch myself every day.
Really. And so let's see. So we were talking about the causes. It seems to me, like as we said, you were getting more and more socially isolated in a lot of ways. And that was probably one of the big causes of what was making you more and more crazy, basically, right?
I mean, absolutely. Social isolation is oftentimes much more debilitating than depression, the disease. If you can imagine that. Depression
is
pretty debilitating.
I mean, like, I hear like they lock people up in isolation in prisons and they go completely mad. And yeah.
Wouldn't you?
Yes.
I mean, you know, we are social creatures. We were meant to be connected to one another. Mm-hmm. We were not meant to exist in isolation. And so, you know, I know the hospital protocols and the healthcare professionals are very well intentioned, but the way they're schooled and the way the healthcare system is set up is very questionable. Many times it's not very humane. And so the practice of confining a person to in an isolation cell, as I was, I can see the rationale for why people do that, but I would invite them to go beyond protocols to connect and reconnect with the person, not just the patient.
Yeah.
And see if there are other pathways to reaching out to this person in their time of absolutely acute distress and helping them heal.
Helping them just get kind of come back and included in the world. And there were a lot of different things. I mean, like, for instance, when you moved to America, you were in an arranged marriage, and for a while in America, it was okay. But then you had a baby, and I think you got postpartum depression.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, and I write a chapter called just my coming to the U.S. and my early years in the U.S. and it was blissful, and so I thought I had beat it, uh-huh. Whatever it was, these demons of my mind, that I had beat it. And then we had our first child and we were delighted. And as the baby grew joyous and by the day, more resplendent by the minute.
Roshini is her name?
Roshini, which means light.
Yeah.
I grew more despondent. And we did not know that it was postpartum depression. And that's the irony, right? I mean, she was born in the late 80s.
Right.
And my husband and I diligently went to every Lamaze class. And so we thought we were prepared. And I read Benjamin Spock's books and every, you know, What to Expect When You're Expecting and all the other books about parenting and childbirth and the whole thing. But for some reason, we were not educated. I mean, postpartum depression wasn't actively talked and discussed about, not in the Lamaze classes, not in the media, not anywhere, right? So when I developed postpartum depression, I believed the demons were back.
Right.
And that it was my personal failing. And so, of course, I hid it again because I was scared. I was scared if I shared my symptoms, the horrors in my mind, with my husband or my family, that they would know that I was crazy and that for the safety of the baby, that they would take custody of her and put me in a mental hospital. And all I knew, which unfortunately came true later on, all I knew about mental hospitals through the media, of course, is that they lock people away for life. Of course, I'm glad to find that I wasn't locked away for life, but I was locked up not once but twice right here at the Oregon Health Science and University Hospital, twice within 10 days, and I lost a pregnancy in between as well. But getting locked up set me free.
Uh-huh. And that was a huge part of it. You ended up actually starting to finally like know that this, that you weren't, okay, well, like you didn't have devils in you. You didn't have, this was just a what would you call it exactly?
It's a human experience, right? It's a wake-up call that something is out of balance,
right?
It's the invitation for a journey of transformation, which is what it is. Yes, we can call it just a clinical disease, but it's so much more than that. It's so much more than that.
We do have a caller, Joanne.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Joanne. Would you like to ask us?
Yes, I wanted to ask the author. I know very little about India, but that it's a large country and has a lot of culture and diversity. That's all I know. But anyway, Cable had a program this morning on assisted suicide, or I don't know what the technical words used in our country for it are. I had a program on it, and I was wondering, and the man referred to Switzerland about to get information or something about it. I was wondering, in India, is there a stigma, or is there support for if a person wants to end their life when they're old or got bad health or mentally ill? Is cultures in India against that type of thing, like we seem to be in this country? And I'll listen off the air.
Well, thank you for your question. I am by no measure an expert on this topic at all. Death by dignity is what you're referring to that we have here legally available in Oregon. I am not an expert in the arena at all, but from what little I know, I don't believe there is such a legal policy in India that supports death by dignity. Is there a stigma about ending one's life in the event that there is a terminal illness? There's stigma about a lot of issues in India, and this I'm going to suspect will have, you know, there'll be a stigma about it, but I'm not sure.
One of the things I did notice in the book was this stigma part that came from your being in India of the hoochie, which is a crazy person.
Yeah.
And you were kind of terrified of that.
Yes. Growing up in India, you know, my only understanding of a person with mental illness is what I saw on the streets of Bangalore. And I distinctly remember this, you know, bedraggled woman, half naked, running down the streets of India, dogs barking, people chasing her, kids mostly chasing her, pelting her with stones and calling her hoochie, which means crazy. So when I was given a diagnosis of mental illness, I automatically imagined that would be my fate. And yet, I didn't want it to be my fate. It was a terrifying fate and a very shameful and a dishonoring fate. And I didn't want it. And yet, I couldn't see myself as a quote-unquote normal human being. And I didn't want to be seen as a crazy woman. So it was a difficult place to be in accepting myself and accepting mental illness, more importantly,
right,
as part of the human experience and having understanding and deep, deep empathy and compassion for that woman. And it wasn't until I had a stranger come to visit me at the Oregon Health Science University Hospital during my hospitalization there, a stranger that came to visit me to hold me in her arms and look me in my eyes and tell me, "You're not crazy, honey. I too have struggled just like you ever since I was 16 or 18 years old. And I'm here to hold you in my arms and tell you that you're not crazy. You're not lazy. You're not bewitched. You're not possessed. You're just a human being that has a deadly disease. And you have the, more than anything, you have the power within you to transform your life. And all I want you to do is to promise me that you will never, ever again try to kill yourself. Because there is hope, and you have the power within you to heal and become whole again." And life is beautiful, Stephanie, really. You know, it's such a sweet journey. Her name is Aida, and I call her Aida the angel. Aida is in her 80s, and her husband is struggling with Alzheimer's, an acute illness. And when we launched the book at Powell's Bookstore on March 12th, Aida was in a wheelchair, but sitting right there.
Beautiful.
In the front row, where I could pay my tribute, not only for her compassion and the gift of hope that she gave me, a gift of hope, you know, hope that sees the invisible, mm-hmm. feels the intangible, mm-hmm. and achieves the impossible. Such is the gift that Aida gave me that day. Such is the gift that has helped me transform my life from its ruins to its wholeness the way I have. Such is the gift that I wish and I pray to pay it forward to the 450 million men, women, and children struggling with mental illness around the world, to hold them in my heart and to let them know that they're not alone, that they don't have to be afraid, they don't have to be ashamed, that we are in this together.
And so this was like sort of your first glimmer that you could be a human being with this crippling mind and still be okay.
Yeah, seeing is believing, Stephanie. Yeah. You know, Aida was this beautiful Armenian woman. If you can imagine, she was a blend of Jackie Kennedy and Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so looking into her eyes, I could envision to be her instead of the so-called crazy woman on the streets of Bangalore.
The hoochie, yeah.
Instead of being a hoochie.
And another friend that apparently helped you a lot, you got a part-time job or a temporary job. And I was reading that you were having a really hard time functioning there. You would just get sort of paralyzed and catatonic. And a woman there asked you what was wrong. And
yeah, of all the places in this world, Intel. I had a job as a software administrator.
At Intel.
At Intel, of all the places in the world, because my family and I believed that having a job would cure my ills. Right. And here I was completely terrified by technology. I was scared of a mouse. I didn't know how to operate a computer. And I was supposed to be a software administrator. I was grateful for the job opportunity. But this gal who I called Julie in the book, and she would be happy that I can share her name with you. Her name is Jean McNamara. So wherever you are, Jean, she's today a nurse. She was an engineer at Intel back then, and today she's a, you know, she's a nurse saving people around the world. So yeah, I used to be completely paralyzed with panic attacks and depression. And so I would lock myself in the bathroom stall, shove my fist into my mouth and scream and cry and let it all out, and then take a few deep breaths and peek out to make sure that there was nobody in the bathroom, then get out of the stall and wash my face, powder my face, and get back to my office.
Try to look normal again,
yes. One of those times I had no idea. I thought the coast was clear, and I dashed out of the bathroom and I ran smack into Jean and just collapsed on the floor. And she was so, so concerned. She was a good friend of mine and my husband. And she was very concerned, not knowing why. Because from the outside, I looked pretty normal. Of course, it's a facade that most of us with mental health issues want to put on. Mm-hmm. Because we need to survive in this world, right? But what happened next set me free, right? In so many ways, she didn't run away. Mm-hmm. When I, you know, told her the gory details of not just my struggles with depression and my attempts to kill myself, but being molested by a priest in India, and the ongoing trauma and the, you know, the isolation and the pain that I felt living like prisoners in our own home here in Portland. Not even our best friends knew, because we believed that if they did, they would shun us, that they would ostracize us. And here was this brilliant engineer holding me in her arms, cradling me, promising me that she would stand by me and throughout my journey through recovery and help me find the right resources. And more than anything, to remind me and to tell me, you are an incredibly strong and smart woman, and I am so proud of you. And you have the strength within you. You will get better, and I'm going to help you, right? Again, yet another role model, so to say, of a person with a mental illness, because again, Jean also struggled with depression, right? And here was this brilliant engineer having a great career at Intel, holding me in her arms, nonetheless on the floor of the bathroom, but still reassuring me that I too can recover and heal just like she had.
That you were being accepted, you were being included, you were, yes, these things that are just so important to being a human being.
And she saw the potential in me. She saw, she told me that I was smart,
mm-hmm.
that I was caring, that I was compassionate, that I was strong, right? These are not words that you hear at home. And I don't blame our families, because they see us in the worst of our, you know, situations. And to them, of course, strength, intelligence, are not courage, are not the words that they can think of when I am trying to kill myself.
Right.
Or I am barely able to function. They don't, they only see me as somebody broken and weak.
Yeah, and you're seeing yourself that way.
Of course.
And so, well, I just want to take a quick break here. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. This is The Recovery Zone. And today's guest is a woman from India who now lives in Portland for the last 30 years, actually, who's recovered from decades of debilitating depression. Gayathri Rampasad has written a memoir, Shadows in the Sun, and she's founded an organization to help others like herself around the world. It's called ASHA International, A-S-H-A International. And so you started to get therapy. You started to realize that you weren't all by yourself in this. You were actually locked up a couple of times, you said it. And what actually, besides just feeling included, what were the kinds of things that you were doing? Like, I know that for a while there you were on medications, but they didn't actually help you.
Right.
And what kinds of things were working then to get you out of this?
Absolutely. You know, as terrified as I was about hospitalization, true, I was confined twice within 10 days in the isolation cell. I lost the pregnancy in between. It was the most traumatic experience of my life, but it was ultimately life transforming. It is there in the hospital that for the first time I met others like myself, the so-called lunatics of the world. And there amidst all the madness, I discovered courage and compassion and acceptance and inclusion like I had never found in the so-called sane world outside of the hospital. There within the hospital, I had phenomenal healthcare professionals that taught me so many different skills, whether it was about stress relaxation or stress management, time management, occupational therapy, relaxation techniques. You know, in so many ways, the psych ward became my school.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a Buddhist quote that says, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. There are a lot of people that I write about in the book. Nurse Sue, who was one such transformational agent in my life, and the patients, and so many other physicians and, you know, staff at the hospital. And you are right. You know, it is where I began my road to recovery. But unfortunately, the medications were not helping me heal. You know, unfortunately, the very same medications that were supposed to alleviate my symptoms were exacerbating them. So the antidepressants were making me more depressed, more suicidal. The anti-anxiety medications were making me more jittery, more anxious, right? And back then, we didn't have science to prove what my soul knew.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, I knew in my soul that something was wrong, that these so-called medications prescribed by experts with all the good intentions were somehow not helping me. And so I still remember standing in the window on 5 East at St. Vincent Hospital overlooking Barnes Road and 217, the intersection, and wanting and desperately aching to be part of the normalcy of life. I could see a mother take a child in her stroller for a walk. I could see cars whizzing by. I could see myself imprisoned behind those windows in a psych ward, and yet somewhere deep inside knowing that I had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I had a choice to continue to live the way I did, or I had a choice to take control of my life. And I'm so glad that I had the courage that day to take control of my life and to say, I'm going to get off the meds.
And you just did it on your own.
On my own.
The doctors
kind of
were concerned about this.
They were concerned. I was concerned. My family was concerned. But it was under, you know, under the supervision of my psychiatrist. And I'm so grateful to him. And so I did. I did wean myself off. And of course, you know, that isn't just the end of the story.
No.
So what if I got off of meds? You know, I still needed to learn how to live well,
uh-huh,
right? And this is where I began to learn, get introduced, really. Ironically, although I was born and raised in India, where transcendental meditation and yoga and pranayama, all of these forms of, you know, wellness practices that had originated, nobody in my family nor I practiced these, you know, skills. And yet here I was in America, having nearly lost my mind and life several times over, to be introduced to these Indian concepts by American teachers.
Wow.
And the practice of meditation and pranayama and yoga for the last 25 years has transformed my life, as has cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, incredibly powerful in teaching me how to get in tune with my thoughts and how my thoughts affect my emotions and my moods and how my moods and my emotions affect my feelings and my behavior and my actions.
And your body.
And my body and my mind and my environment, right? And most importantly, how I had the power to choose to respond to to these thoughts and to these emotions. So for example, if I was feeling suicidal, it wasn't a fact that I needed to end my life. You know, one of the most powerful lessons I learned from my therapist was that feelings aren't facts. And that's the truth, you know. Just because I'm suicidal in this moment
doesn't mean it's true, that you have to do it.
That I don't have an option. That just because I'm feeling so utterly depressed and desperate to end my life doesn't mean that this feeling of depression, which tells me that I am a worthless human being, always have been, always will be, that there's never been hope in my life, never will be, that ending my life is a very logical action to take because it's from the goodness of my heart and the compassion, because nobody wants to live with a despicable person like me because I'm just a burden, right? And so ending my life is a phenomenal act of love, right, by getting rid of a burden to my family.
And these are actually just all thoughts that you didn't have to believe anymore.
Absolutely. The trouble for decades was that I believed in them and I acted on them, right? So cognitive behavioral therapy was phenomenally powerful. And I have to confess, you know, coming from India, you know, I didn't have the concept of therapists.
Right.
So, you know, of course, we all think that all mental health professionals are quacks as well because they must be crazy. Why else would they get a profession like that, right? And so I certainly had all those misperceptions as well and didn't understand how bearing my soul to a stranger would help me heal. And yet I've had phenomenal therapists in my life that really have held a mirror to the light within me, this light of love and compassion and courage and wisdom that is inherent in all of us, right? I was blinded to my own light for so many years of my life, like many of us are. And yet I've had incredible teachers, like therapists, that became the mirrors that held a light to my inner light. They were the mirrors that helped me see the strength within me, the wisdom within me, the courage and compassion within me.
And that you, I mean, also express that everyone has this. You know,
all of us go through times of darkness. Yeah. You know, it could be the loss of a loved one, the loss of a job, the loss of a grade. And, you know, we have to talk about the horrific incidents in Santa Barbara that have been unfolding. What a tragedy.
Right.
Here was a young man who felt deeply isolated and disconnected from his community, from his world.
Incredibly alone.
Very alone. It's a very frightening place to be. And yet, I'm so sorry that he didn't find the light within himself to understand his pain instead of unleashing pain on others.
He really just didn't get the help that he could have, that might have changed everything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that I think a lot of what goes on, I mean there's these incredible statistics. By the way, if listeners would like to call in, the phone number here at KBOO is 503-731-0470. I'm sorry, 503-231-8187. Yeah, boy, 503-231-8187. Anyway, we've got just incredible statistics going on in America. Like, for instance, I think young people are twice as likely to be depressed and suicidal as older people, you know, people under 24. I was reading that there's something like 55,000 beds available now for people to get treatment in the U.S., but back in the 50s, there was 555,000 beds. I mean, we have really cut the potential for people getting any kind of care or treatment. Some 9 million people are going to be seriously mental ill this year in the U.S., but only 40% of them are going to get even any kind of treatment. And what's happening with that? Like, why is this such a, you know, and what can we be doing about it?
Education, advocacy, you know, that's where it all starts. And there are incredible efforts underway. And the journey has just begun. The fight for human rights and social justice has just begun. And I want to focus on what is good. The goodness is in the fact that people like you and me are starting the conversation and sustaining the conversation, not just about mental illness, but more importantly on mental health. And going back to the phenomenal incidence of mental illness in our youth, it is a tragedy. There are a lot of causes and reasons why, but here's the tragedy. Our prisons have become our new asylums.
Exactly.
And how very tragic. You know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of children and youth in our prisons across the U.S. today. So many of them struggling with mental health issues that have not received the treatment and are in there for minor infractions. And again, I'm not condoning their acts, but I'm asking for our community to have the compassion to understand why they committed those acts and why we as a global community and as adults and as parents and as policymakers need to start listening, need to believe what we are seeing, that this is a epidemic.
It is.
And we need to put not only our ingenuity and our creativity together, but our humanity and our compassion and our creativity together in addressing what is such a tragedy. Such a tragedy. But I have faith, I really do have faith, that together we can make recovery
a
reality.
And when you started getting over this, you first started hooking up with a group called the National Alliance for Mental Health, and you started to... You were actually trying to organize a walk for mental health, weren't you?
Well, NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness, that was really my entry into the world of mental health advocacy. And I, in grad school, I got my MBA at George Fox University. And in the social entrepreneurship class, we were all required to write a business plan. And at that point in time, my sister, who's 2 years younger than me, was struggling with schizoaffective disorder. And I never knew when the phone rang if she was dead or dying. She had tried to kill herself so many different times. And so I wrote a business plan for a nationwide walk. And in my dream, I could envision me and my sister emerging out of the dark and into the light of a new era, out of shame and into a world where we would hold our heads high in pride and in solidarity. And so I wrote this business plan much like a love song to my sister in the hopes that she and I would emerge out of the dark one day and into the light. And I then started researching to see if there were organizations around the U.S. that could partner with me in bringing this walk alive. And as serendipity had it, I got in touch with NAMI Oregon, and they were in their infancy in discussing plans with NAMI National to bring a nationwide walk alive. And they'd been working with a consultant from the March of Dimes program. And that's how the NAMI Walks for the Mind was born.
And they're happening every year now.
And they're happening every year now. And I became a member of their strategic team, a steering committee here in Portland, which was one of the 13 sites chosen across the U.S. for the inaugural NAMI Walks for the Mind of America. And then it was an incredible, incredible experience for me. And I got introduced into the In Our Own Voice program that NAMI has, a wonderful recovery education program, and presented the program across the state and around the country, and served on the board of NAMI Oregon for a couple of years. And I learned a lot. And what I learned was that there wasn't enough focus on multicultural mental health.
Uh-huh.
NAMI is doing phenomenal work in educating our communities and supporting people and families with mental health issues. Those of us that are from other cultures, whether it's India or Indonesia or China or Japan or Somalia, it doesn't matter. America is a country of immigrants, and we are a melting pot of a great deal of cultures, and culture counts. Culture and cultural perceptions or misperceptions about mental illness can mean the difference between sanity and insanity, life and death, as it did in my life. But culture also has inherent powers and pathways to health and healing. Like my culture has the gifts of yoga and meditation.
Right.
And every culture has inherent pathways to healing. So I became very curious to study the impact of culture in mental illness and mental health, most importantly, and to also start an organization which would focus not just on the multicultural mental health aspects, but to give voice to people like myself, voices that were so long silenced. And going back to our initial question about, does it take another gay movement, just like the gay movement, to give face, mm-hmm. to put a face, to bring social justice to board? I believe so. So through ASHA International, that is our hope, that is our prayer, that we are going to humanize mental illnesses. We are going to offer hope and healing to individuals that are struggling with mental health issues around the world and their families. And most importantly, we're going to focus on promoting holistic wellness. You know, there's a the medical model, the treatment plan, so to say, comprises of hospitalizations, medications, and shock treatments, and cognitive behavioral therapy. Well, wellness, first of all, doesn't come encapsulated in a pill.
Right.
It encompasses the way we live. So at ASHA International, we focus on empowering individuals to realize the power that they have to transform their own lives, the power to transform their lives through breath work, through meditation, through exercise, through nutrition, through social connectedness. We were talking about isolation just a minute ago. Social connections, you know, community provides immunity.
Yeah.
It's just as simple.
And I do have a caller just called. What's your name? Tyrone, could you, what's your question?
I just wanted to say to Gayatri, you sure you explained it just perfectly. Let us not forget about the patients still at Oregon State Hospital, like Enrique, who called me and said, Tyrone, don't give up the fight. So I totally understand what you're saying. It all makes sense to me. And I definitely think people need to take time out and get to know people with mental illness, because we're just people like anybody else.
Yeah.
And what I've experienced is people calling me crazy. They don't even know me, and they're calling me crazy. I can't even walk out my door and go to the bus stop on the corner without someone saying something crazy about me, and that person doesn't even know me. So I just think that people need to get to know at least one person that they can try to understand and understand what mental illness is all about. So Gayatri, I just want to thank you. And again, I want to tell you, you are radiant.
She is.
Even though you suffer from depression, keep shining. And she said, glowing, I'm saying, enlightening.
Thank you, Tyrone. Thank you. And, you know, every person in this world should have the privilege of getting to know Tyrone. He is the most gentle, compassionate, caring person I've ever known. And there are a million and more, millions and millions of Tyrones around the world. Some of them are, you know, in our state hospitals. Some of them are in prisons around the world. Some of them are on our streets. Some of them are in our corporate world. Some of them are in our homes and in our communities, at our churches and at our temples, and yet they're hidden away. They're hidden away because they're terrified that sharing their truth will lead them to lives of isolation and pain, like Tyrone just described, that he can't even go to the bus stop without people calling him crazy. And people call him crazy not because they know him, because if they knew him, they would call him brave. They would call him beautiful. They would call him compassionate. So my prayer to the world, please have heart. Have compassion.
I want to let people know again, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, and I'm speaking with Gayatri Rampasad, a woman raised in India who found herself caught up in depression so severe she made several suicide attempts. And with help and understanding, you've managed to heal and has written a vivid memoir, Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. She's also started an organization called ASHA International. And I'd like to talk sort of as the time we have left here about ASHA a little more. You got started on that. What exactly are some of the programs and where are you going with this? Or I mean, like are you all over the world with ASHA? Or?
It's a great question, Stephanie. First of all, ASHA International is the culmination of the promise that I made in that isolation cell, a promise that for every day that I had lived in despair, that I would bring hope to the lives of others like us, like me and my family around the world, and that for every indignity that I had suffered in shame and silence, I would not only fight to restore my dignity, but the dignity of others like me in this world. It only took me 16 years to realize my promise, but here we are in 2006.
You started at 2006.
Yeah, April 2006, I had the incredible fortune of collaborating with a wonderful, wonderful group of mental health advocates here in Portland to start ASHA International. ASHA literally means hope in Sanskrit, one of the world's most ancient languages that originated in my home country of India, and in Hindi, India's national language. In English, ASHA is an acronym for a source of hope for all touched by mental illness. And at ASHA International, that's what we aspire to do, to give hope to every person that we are privileged to meet, right? And when I started ASHA International in 2006, my humble prayer was that I could transform all the lessons that I had learned in pain to bring hope to one person struggling with mental illness, just one person like Tyrone or myself. And yet here I am, believe it or not, having reached out to more than 32,000 people nationally and internationally with a resounding message of hope and healing. The most beautiful gift, however, is helping others has helped me heal and become whole again, right? So at ASHA International, we have, first of all, we're a nonprofit organization based here in Portland, Oregon, and our mission is to promote personal, organizational, and community wellness through mental health education, training, and support. Our fundamental purpose is to promote mental health awareness and to bring hope and healing to people struggling with mental health issues and their families. Our signature campaign is called Healthy Minds, Healthy Lives, and under the umbrella of which we present a wide variety of mental health education programs, wellness workshops, cultural competence trainings, peer mentoring, referrals, and resources.
And where you're doing this in India?
Geographically speaking, it's literally the world is our playground.
Uh-huh.
It's wherever our resources and the invitations come from, and more than anything, you know, it's so phenomenally important to have strategic partners that believe in our mission and that support our mission. So far since 2006, you know, we worked presented programs across the U.S. in Singapore and across India.
Mm-hmm. And are you finding that people who are responding to this in such a way, like what are they ending up doing?
It is phenomenal, right? I mean, we could only sustain ourselves based on the strength of the testimonials that we receive from around the world, mm-hmm. right? What I've learned is that mental illness has no barriers of age or socioeconomic status or culture or geographical boundaries. And even more importantly, hope and healing have no boundaries. So in simply me, this is the power of the human story. Mm-hmm. This is the power of a testimonial of the human spirit and the resilience inherent in each of us to soar beyond the confines of any illness or any isolation cell in the world. You know, what my journey has taught me is that mental illness can break my mind and the mental health system can confine my body, but there are no walls in this world to contain my spirit. So when I stand up on a podium or my other colleagues at ASHA International, it's always about the power of the human story, the power of the human story of resilience, of hope, of courage, of compassion. So that needs no translation. Mm-hmm. You know, although I'm from India, I can only present in English. I can speak 3 or 4 Indian dialects, but I cannot present in any of the Indian languages. So I used to be really concerned, for example, going back home to India, how would I reach out to people? And what I learned is hope and healing literally don't need translation. I have translators, of course, literally speaking, everywhere I present in India. Sometimes there are men. Sometimes they are clinicians, sometimes they are stay-at-home moms that are translating for me. It just doesn't matter. You know, today I was very, very saddened as I was driving here to the studio to hear that Maya Angelou, one of my most favorite people in this world, has passed. She was 86 years old. And what Maya Angelou taught me was the power of love, the power of love to transcend and transform and set us free, the power of truth, as she writes in Why the Caged Bird Sings. Our truth may be horrific, or we may think so, or we may be brainwashed to believe that it is so. I certainly was, and many people with mental illness are brainwashed into believing that mental illnesses are so horrendous that they're unspeakable. And that's where the stigma and the shame and the isolation sets in. And I was one of those people raised in a country where we were raised with a philosophy in India that, you know, quotes, truth alone triumphs. And yet I knew, as my family knew, that the truth about my mental illness would destroy us all. And it took me decades to rewrite that story, rewrite that philosophy. And today to stand in front of the world in great humility to proclaim, yes, truth will set us free.
Right.
The truth that we, the people with mental illnesses, are human beings with potential. What we need is, like Mother Teresa says, understanding and love and compassion.
Right. Not being locked up, not being called crazy, not, and even though there is a certain, like, it's a funny line of like, well, they're not quite with me here, but to sort of understand that underneath that, the humanity of the person.
Right.
Right.
Certainly wanting to kill myself is crazy.
Totally.
I completely agree with right. that. But I'm not in a sane mind or body or spirit when I am thinking and contemplative right. ending my life. So it is that pain that one needs to connect with.
Right.
Why is this person feeling that desperate? Most people with, you know, who commit suicide or who attempt suicide are doing so in a moment of pain and anguish. They want the pain to end.
Right.
Know? So, but I would like to go back to a more hopeful note, right? Even in the depths of suicidal ideation, if we can reach out to people, hold them in our hearts and our compassion and our love and our thoughts and our prayers, and let them know how precious they are, and that this too shall pass, and we will be with them during this time of darkness until they can discover the light within.
And so if people want to get, say, involved in ASHA International, there's a website for it?
Yes. We would love to hear from people. You know, there's a quote that says, it takes a village to raise a child.
Right.
Well, it takes a community to care for humanity. So we welcome everybody to come visit us at myasha.org, myasha.org. There are lots of volunteering opportunities. We would love sponsors to present our programs in the community. Lots of opportunities to get involved and make a difference.
And to really do this, as you said, from a intercultural or different, you know, all the different cultures that are involved.
From a multicultural, humanistic, holistic perspective.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And the other thing is, well, did you have any, like, just last thoughts that then you wanted to share with the listeners?
Well, you know, one of the thoughts that I definitely want to share with our listeners and with the world at large is that no matter where you are, no matter who you are, if you're struggling with a mental illness, please, please don't give up. Have hope. There is help available. Reach out to the sources in your own community. Certainly reach out to us at ASHA International, and know that there's nothing to be afraid or ashamed of. And know that with effective treatment and a whole lot of hard work and unconditional love and support of your family and friends, you too will recover and thrive just the way I have.
Right. And you are still... Just one last thought. You still work with this on your... I mean, you have to periodically, you get hit with it, but you're able to deal with it now.
Absolutely. You know, depression is not a thing of the past in my life. It is recurrent. I do have relapses. But here's what I've learned, that I don't perceive depression to be a demon anymore. Depression truly is a teacher whose wisdom I seek. Depression has certainly caused a great deal of pain in my life and that of my families, but it has brought us so many gifts. You know, it has taught me the power of love to heal all wounds. It has taught me about the fragility of human life. And more than anything, it has taught me of the invincible resilience of the human spirit. So to depression, I say namaste and thank you.
Thank you. You don't want to change the fact that you've lived this life.
No, I am who I am. Because of the pain. It is in the pain that I discovered my purpose. It's in the midst of madness that I have discovered a new meaning to my life. So it's all good.
It's all good. Well, I just want to thank you so much, Gayathri. You've been listening to Gayathri, let's see here, You've tuned to KBOO Portland, listening to Gayathri Rampachat, who wrote a book, Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. It's an incredibly moving story. It's really worth reading. And she's also, and it just follows her from India to the U.S. and all the things that she went through and how she managed to overcome this. And I want to thank you for listening. This is Stephanie Potter, The Recovery Zone, KBOO Portland, and thank you, Tammy. Engineer.
And it's just about 12 o'clock. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And stay tuned next. We got the KBOO Noon headlines coming up. And after that, Jazz Lives with Nick Graffro waiting in the wings to take care of the jazz situation. Thanks for listening to Public Affairs this morning on KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, May 28, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Oregon and Washington have applied for a $75 million grant to create an advanced carbon composite manufacturing center. If they win the contest and the center is created, it will focus on developing the techniques for manufacturing carbon composites for auto parts, wind blades, and pressure vessels. Even though the significant advances achieved by Oregon and Washington in carbon composites for aerospace are not included in the selection criteria, it was decided the states could not possibly pass on this opportunity.
The mass slaying at the University of California, Santa Barbara last Friday by a male student angry with women has caused many organizations to begin examining the